and welcome to this month's edition of the Astropod. I'm Lauren Weiss.
And I'm Maciek Hermanowicz.
Thank you to all of those of you who came to visit us on our open day last month, and especially to those of you who asked questions at the Ask an Astronomer stall.
Indeed, and right at this moment, our editorial team is working very hard to compile all of those into a special edition, which will be released later during the month. So stay in tune, check the website, and hopefully some of you will be able to hear you on the special edition of the Astropod.
While it was really great to see so many of you at the open day, unfortunately that marks the end of our public observing season. This is because it is now getting lighter in the evenings as summer approaches, and so it's harder to see the stars from here in Cambridge. So keep checking the website, and we will hopefully see more of you next fall.
However, as a consolation to all of you who enjoyed the public observing, we now have an Ask an Astronomer section available on the public outreach website. So go to www.ask.cam.ac.uk/public and ask all the questions you want, and hopefully somebody will answer those in due course.
So, Maciek, I've got a question for you, speaking of asking an astronomer something.
Good God, go ahead.
So, what's going on in the world of astronomy?
I would say the most important news that have turned up since the last Astropod was the publishing of the Decadal Review for Planetary Science by the US National Academy of Sciences.
So, what's that?
It's basically the document that summarizes the goals of the field for the next decade, and they defined that as 2013 to 2022, summarizing which missions are going to take the highest priority as far as funding is concerned.
So which missions have been ranked highest?
Sadly enough, there's no human spaceflight predicted by this review because of the scrapping of the space shuttles. And there's no technology operational at this stage. So, sadly, no human spaceflight. Fortunately, though, the top priority is a mission called MAX-C, which is another rover which is going to be sent to Mars. Now, the very exciting thing about that planned mission is hopefully it's going to be a sample return one.
So this mission will pick up some of the Martian soil and bring it back to Earth.
Indeed, not only the soil, it will also extract cores from some of the rocks it finds on the surface of Mars. And hopefully it will launch in 2018. So by 2000 and I would say by 2025, we will be able to look at details of Martian rocks in the laboratories on Earth, which is going to be an extremely exciting opportunity, I have to say. And the way it works, because obviously it's going to be a bit tough to get the samples back, what the rover will do, it will carry a small device, probably a small rocket, that will launch the samples once they are collected. They will get launched into the orbit, and then a second spacecraft will be sent on a flyby orbit from Earth, pick them up in the Martian orbit and fetch them back to Earth, and they are still ironing out the technical details for that. I'm really looking forward to how it will work out.
So this is like playing catch in outer space.
Yes, indeed. How exciting is that?
That's pretty amazing. And these samples coming back from Mars. So we've had samples from the moon and from some comets, but is this the first time that we are getting samples of the rock and soil from another planet in our solar system?
Pretty much the first time when we are guaranteed it's not going to be contaminated, because obviously we have some of the meteorites that have originated from Mars and have been identified as such. Now, the problems with those are they have been in the outer space for quite a long time, so that might have affected them somewhat. And then another problem is they're only found on Earth a few years, sometimes hundreds of years after they fell down. So we have no guarantee they are still preserved in the pristine condition. But this one will be fresh rocks from Mars. I'm up for that.
I'm very much looking forward to that.
Just very briefly, the other ones up on the shopping lists are a mission to Europa, the moon of Jupiter, that should confirm the presence of the hypothetical ocean underneath the icy surface of the moon, which should be quite exciting. And if that fails to fly because of technical difficulties in the design, a backup option is an orbiter mission to Uranus, which will do some atmospheric probing and will be the first dedicated mission to that planetary system, which should be quite exciting as well. And then obviously a follow-up on the New Frontiers set of missions, which produce a faster, sort of shorter time scale, small missions of opportunity to other planets. So it's looking quite exciting, I would say. And I think it's time for Laura to give us some more news.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Japan quake may have shortened Earth's day. On March 11, the magnitude 8.9 earthquake in Japan may have shortened the length of Earth's day and shifted the Earth's axis. But don't worry, the effects are too small to notice. Scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California modelled the movement of the tectonic plates involved to calculate how the earthquake changed the distribution of the Earth's mass. They predict that the earthquake would have caused the Earth to rotate a bit faster, shortening the length of the day by about 1.8 microseconds. It also means that the axis around which the Earth's mass is balanced, called the figure axis, has shifted by about 17 centimetres. The figure axis isn't the same as the north-south axis, there's an offset of about 10 metres between them. Such small changes in the Earth's rotation and figure axis happen all the time, not only as a result of earthquakes, but also due to large-scale effects of atmospheric winds and ocean currents. Over the course of a year, these effects change the length of the day by about a millisecond, about 550 times the change caused by the Japan quake. So such changes in the Earth's rotation are quite natural and happen all the time. Vast areas of low-latitude subsurface ice found on Mars. There may be more ice below the Martian surface than previously thought, and vast regions of it may lie just south of the equator. Observations from two spacecraft, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Express, have revealed these potential subsurface ice deposits. This is the first evidence of ice on Mars at tropical latitudes within 25 degrees of the equator. The team of scientists at Brown University believe that the subsurface ice could be remnants of the last ice age on Mars. Any future Mars mission, such as the Mars Science Laboratory, needs to land within 25 degrees of the equator due to safety and engineering constraints. So the discovery of possibly significant amounts of ice at these latitudes is very exciting. Hubble rules out one alternative to dark energy. Astronomers using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope have ruled out an alternative theory on the nature of dark energy after recalculating the expansion rate of the universe to unprecedented accuracy. The universe appears to be expanding at an increasing rate. Some believe that it is because the universe is filled with dark energy that causes the expansion. One alternative to that hypothesis is that an enormous bubble of relatively empty space, 8 billion light years across, surrounds our galactic neighbourhood. If we lived near the centre of this void, observations of galaxies being pushed away from each other at accelerating speeds would be an illusion. Researchers led by Adam Rees at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore refined the accuracy of the Hubble constant to a precision that allows for a better characterization of dark energy's behaviour. Rees's team first had to determine accurate distances to galaxies near and far from Earth. The team compared those distances with the speed at which the galaxies are apparently receding because of the expansion of space. They used these two values to calculate the Hubble constant, the number that relates the speed at which a galaxy appears to recede to its distance from the Milky Way. The observations helped determine a figure for the universe's current expansion rate to an uncertainty of just 3.3% and allowed the team to rule out the bubble hypothesis of accelerating expansion. Discovery's last flight. Discovery has successfully completed its final mission. The shuttle returned to Earth for the last time on the 9th of March. Discovery's 17-year career has included 39 separate missions, spending a total of 365 days in space and orbiting the Earth 5,830 times. The final mission was to deliver a module to the International Space Station and help the ISS perform some repairs and system upgrades. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thank you, Laura. So, Maciek, have you been thinking about robots in space lately?
Oh yes, that's what I think about all the time. Now, in fact, there is one particular very exciting robot in space, which just got delivered to the International Space Station by the last Discovery mission, actually.
Really? What kind of robot is this?
It's actually a robotic astronaut designed by NASA.
Whoa!
Yep, it's a human-shaped robot. It's got a torso, a head, and two fairly dexterous hands. And it's meant to be a prototype for a future technology which will allow robots to be used in place of astronauts, say, in doing tasks which may be a bit too dangerous to have humans out, say, a very long spacewalk, for instance.
That seems like a pretty smart idea. Because I guess we are all aware that accidents can happen in space. It's a dangerous mission, a dangerous job to be an astronaut. So
it is a dangerous job, and any technology that can reduce the risk is always welcome. Now, the very smart thing about having a human-shaped robot is that it can use all the tools that the astronauts are using at the moment, and because they're used to operating in those very bulky spacesuit gloves, the slight lack of dexterity on behalf of the robot is not going to be an issue, because frankly, if you wore gloves like that, you wouldn't be able to definitely not play the piano.
So I guess they can use the wrenches and other tools that are on the ISS, and that means that it's cheaper, that we don't have to develop a whole new set of tools for the robot to use.
Yeah, I guess it should be quite a useful approach.
That's really neat. Now it's time for our interview.
Our guest this month is Professor Sri Kulkarni from California Institute of Technology, where he's the director of the Caltech Optical Observatories. Professor Kulkarni is also the Eddington Lecturer visiting IOA this month. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Before we start talking about your research, could you tell our listeners what drove you into astronomy in the first place?
Well, I hate to maybe disappoint some of your listeners. For me, it was because I thought astronomy was the easiest of all the things I could do. I was basically trained as an engineer. I went to a school, Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi, well known for producing engineering graduates, doing something what you'd call as applied physics. During the last year of my undergraduate education, I went to an astronomy summer school. And I thought it was fun, and it was also, I thought, very easy subject. So I said, okay, I'll be an astronomer.
Fun and easy. That's quite a good career choice, isn't it? So then you continued to do your PhD research in America. That was Berkeley, wasn't it?
Right. So, yeah, my career is quite simple. I finished my undergraduate work at Delhi, then I decided to take up to radio astronomy and went to UC Berkeley, where my thesis was on radio astronomy. After that, I went to Caltech, where I've been there for more than a quarter of a century, though over time I've switched from radio to X-ray to optical astronomy.
So you've been pretty much dealing with most of the spectrum of observations available to us. Now, in the title of this year's Eddington lecture you're giving, you call astronomy a subject on the cusp. What do you mean by that?
On the cusp, I chose that deliberately because I think astronomy is certainly enjoying what I'd call its golden phase. You turn to any newspaper practically, even once a day, but certainly within a week or a month, there's always a front page astronomical discovery being reported by astronomers: exoplanets, the beginning of the universe, dark energy, very interesting stars, something about the sun, outer solar system. It's quite a bit. Many subjects go through an interesting phase. In the 60s, for example, high energy physics was very interesting. Particles were discovered, theories were made, particles were discovered, explained, and so on. So I would say that's called golden age. But I think astronomy is more than just golden age right now. When I say it's on the cusp, I think in this decade, there'll be a huge explosion of very large amounts of data in astronomy. Already the more modest surveys, that is by the standards of new surveys that'll be done, such as the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which I'm told your listeners have heard a fair bit, are just the beginning, and this decade we'll see very large amount of data production, and Even the project that I'm going to discuss at my Eddington lecture today will talk of a rather modest telescope, but producing tens of terabytes of data and our inability to digest all this. This is a classic symptom of a subject that is about to enter a very rich phase.
Let's talk about that project a bit more then. It's called the Palomar Transient Factory, and now the factory bit is especially promising. So could you tell us a bit more about the goal of this project and why you're so excited about it?
Yeah, so traditionally astronomical projects do not have their last word as a factory. It's a survey is a common ending, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the Palomar All Sky Sky Survey, Infrared Sky Survey. And I chose the word factory deliberately. The idea is to give you this sort of a very machine that is more or less working, hopefully as flawlessly as possible, and really producing discoveries or events in almost a predetermined way. And so, for example, the Palomar Sky Transient Factory, we are now in a position to find a supernova maybe every 20 minutes. So more or less you can set your watch and say, okay, end of the night we should have between 10 and 30 supernovae. Now this may or may not impress a casual listener, but it wasn't all that in the distant past. When you found a supernova, you actually sent off a telegram to a bureau called the Central Bureau of Telegrams in our business, saying, you know, upon scanning the sky, either with my eye or with my camera, I found a new object located at so-and-so position and so-and-so brightness, and we called it a supernova. So they actually were dealt one at a time, whereas with the project that I and my colleagues began, we are in a position to find, as I said, a dozen supernovae on a good night. So I think the analogy to factory is reasonable at this point.
Also, this seems to be the general direction in which astronomy is moving now, because we got down to being able to observe rather faint objects over a long period. But to be able to reach those levels, we have to integrate over a long period of time. But now the astronomy is beginning to go into the time resolution domain, which is the first time ever. So would you say is that the future of the field?
It's a good future of the field. I think there are several other futures of the field. I mean, if I had to bring out my crystal ball, I could put four other things, but this is a clear future of the field. One thing I do have to correct you, about 100 years ago, a repeated survey of the sky was very fashionable. Places like Harvard University undertook large plate surveys. They're still preserved, at Harvard, the Harvard plate collection. And then it went out of sort of fashion. So in that sense, we are sort of, back to the days of repeated survey of the sky. And it's a natural evolution. The first thing you do is you survey the sky to a certain depth, and the satellite surveys, large telescopes, they've done a very good job. So the next thing is to keep surveying to find new things, which are supernovae, moving objects such as asteroids, and variable sources. So definitely, I think this is one of the four big things I think that'll happen in this decade.
What are the other three ones then?
Certainly extrasolar planets, there's no question. We now have exceeded, I think, the astronomical count is now more than 500 confirmed ones. Kepler alone has about 1,200 candidate planets, and a few tens of them are very interesting, and so on and so forth. So I would say the general study of extrasolar planets, not as planet objects themselves, but the formation of planets, planetary architecture, all this sort of area is going to be very, very rich. The structure of the universe, the cosmic background radiation, what it can reveal to us at either the very beginning or projects that will soon start, which will sort of so-called near-field cosmology, which tells us how the universe was at some detail. Those, I think that is a very mature area, but there are some very fundamental questions. As you well know, that the deep relation between quantum mechanics and the universe is best done with the early evolution of the universe, and the cosmic background radiation is a way to probe them. I do think that, I don't know whether it'll happen in this decade or not, but experimental gravity, gravitational wave, astronomy will become a subject. LIGO hopefully will produce some events within this decade. LISA is another mission. So that's sort of a really not just an unexplored band, it's an unexplored messenger of astronomical signals. So I think I've given you my four big things.
And which of them is the one you're looking forward to hearing about most? What's your personal favorite there?
Well, personal favorites have more to do there are two ways to look at these subjects. One is, what do you think is the most important one? Or what do you think is the most important for you? I'm sort of a simple guy. What's most important is what I can do in any of these things. And I'm certainly putting my bet on basically transient object astronomy, the subject of my lecture today, because I think this is very closely related to the issue of experimental gravity, gravitational wave astronomy, which I think will be a wonderful new arena in which astronomy can really probe the physics of physics in a fundamental way. It will be a bit messy. These are faraway objects. It's not a tabletop experiment. But that's the only way we'll make some progress in understanding strong gravity, is through observations. I'm not directly involved in that, but as an astronomer, I hope to be in a supporting role of undertaking electromagnetic localizations of gravitational wave sources. And I hope the project I have now begun and its successor will play a big role in that.
Let's hope for that. Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to have you on our show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's AstroPod History section. Now, our interviewee this month, Professor Kulkarni, has made a large number of important discoveries by observing the sky, not just with visible light, but with invisible light, such as infrared, X-ray, and ultraviolet. So this month, we'll be looking at the history of so-called multi-wavelength astronomy. Now, for thousands of years, astronomy was practiced by observing the night sky with the naked eye or with telescopes. As we know, the eye is sensitive to the range of colours which make up white light, called the visible spectrum. In fact, it was Sir Isaac Newton who first made this conceptual leap, followed by the investigations of the German philosophers Goethe and Schopenhauer. But in 1800, the British-German scientist Sir William Herschel got himself a prism, made himself a spectrum, and stuck a thermometer inside each of the coloured bands that were created. He found that the temperature was highest just beyond the red part of the spectrum, and thus discovered infrared radiation, invisible light, in this case coming from the sun. Over the years, it was established that visible light only represents a tiny fraction of the different types of radiation that nature has to offer. The discovery of infrared was followed by ultraviolet, then radio, X-ray, microwave, and gamma rays in the 20th century. Once suitable telescopes had been invented to detect these new forms of light, it opened up an astonishing new window on the universe. Objects which were once feeble when looked at with the eye shone like beacons when observed with an X-ray or infrared telescope. The reason for this is that we observe astronomical objects in a wide variety of physical settings. The mechanisms responsible for the emission of the light our telescopes pick up can produce different wavelengths. For example, the Milky Way contains a large amount of dust, which absorbs surrounding starlight and re-emits it at infrared wavelengths. Therefore, when viewed in the infrared, the Milky Way appears very bright. Similarly, the strong magnetic fields around neutron stars can cause plasma to emit strong radio waves. The ability to see the universe at different wavelengths opens up a much greater range of physical processes. The first radio telescopes were built by Karl Jansky in the 1930s at the Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, and modern-day radio telescopes are recognizable by their enormous dishes. The first X-ray telescope was mounted on a balloon in 1963 and was used to take images of the sun, But the big leap in technology came in 1978 with the launch of NASA's Einstein Telescope, the first space-based X-ray satellite. The launch of the IRAS in 1983 marked the birth of infrared astronomy, and its modern-day successor is the Herschel Space Telescope, launched in 2009 by the European Space Agency at the same time as Planck, a telescope observing at microwave frequencies. Planck hopes to measure the cosmic microwave background, light emitted just 400,000 years after the Big Bang, which has been cooled by the expansion of the universe to long wavelengths. A typical microwave has a wavelength of about a centimeter. Long wavelengths, such as radio, microwaves, and infrared, correspond to low energies and low temperatures, whilst shorter wavelengths, such as visible light, UV, X-ray, and gamma rays, correspond to high energies. Indeed, the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope, currently orbiting Earth, is searching for high-energy gamma rays from the interactions of the mysterious dark matter that appears to abound in our universe. The discovery of light beyond the visible spectrum has had a huge influence on the development of astronomy in the 20th century, initiating great technological advances, as well as providing us with a wealth of information on exotic physical processes in the universe. Thanks, Herschel.
Thank you very much, Alex. So, Lauren, I've been fairly talkative so far today. What have you heard?
So, it turns out that there's a very exciting mission to a planet in our solar system right now, to Mercury.
Would that be MESSENGER?
That is the MESSENGER spacecraft. And what's exciting about it is that MESSENGER, which is a spacecraft launched by NASA, is that MESSENGER will become the first spacecraft to orbit Mercury.
That is quite impressive. So how is it doing?
Well, the trick is that Mercury, since it's the closest planet to the Sun, has to travel faster than all of the other planets in the solar system to remain in its orbit around the Sun. This is just due to laws of physics. And so the trick is that MESSENGER, which will need to orbit Mercury, has to attain an extremely high speed. So Mercury's average speed around the Sun is 48 kilometers per second, whereas Earth's average speed around the Sun is only 30 kilometers per second.
So there's quite a bit of catching up to do.
Exactly. So MESSENGER so far has gone 5 billion miles, which is much more than the distance between the Earth and Mercury, and has looped around the Sun 15 times to slowly build up the speed that it will need to approach Mercury and make this orbit. Anyway, it achieved this on March 17th. So we now have a craft that has orbited Mercury.
Excellent, and I'm sure it will produce plenty of splendid scientific data.
Yes, actually, it's interesting that you ask. So MESSENGER is equipped with all sorts of instruments that will take readings of Mercury, including a powerful camera to take good images, and a device to measure the magnetic field on Mercury.
That is really exciting, and I look forward to the first press releases with the freshest science from Mercury.
Great, and now time for Alex with the sky at night.
Up in the skies this month, Mercury and Jupiter are very close together just after sunset, around 6:30, in the west during the second half of March and the first few days of April. Let the brightness of Jupiter guide you to the correct spot, and then find Mercury about the length of a finger at arm's length above it. This is difficult to see without a low western horizon, and so viewing it across an ocean or from the top of a tall building is best. However, should you miss it, then there will be a reprise towards the very end of the month, when Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Mars all occupy the same part of the sky in the east at about 15 minutes before sunrise, and this continues long into May, although again you will need a very low horizon to see anything in April. Saturn is high in the south-southeast in Virgo after 9 p.m. this month. The giant storm in its atmosphere that appeared as a bright white spot back in December last year has now spread into a streaky band around the northern hemisphere. The rings are also still opening out and are currently 9 degrees from edge on, so this month will be a good time to observe both these bright features on Saturn. Finally, this month's meteor shower is the Lyrids, seeming to radiate from the constellation Lyra in the east, with a peak of 10 to 20 meteors an hour in the early hours of April 23rd. These are the remnants of the comet Thatcher, discovered in 1861, and will be difficult to see due to the brightness of the moon at the time, so the best observations will be made before the moon rises at around 2 a.m. And that's it for the sky and night this month. Now back to Lauren and Magic.
Thank you very much, Alex. So, Lauren, how do you like your wine?
Well, I like wine, but what does this have to do with astronomy?
Basically, it's wine glasses is one of the places where you can observe an effect that's being investigated on the International Space Station right now.
Really? What sort of effect?
So basically, this is a... If you want to see it, dear listeners, next time you're having a glass of wine, try holding it against the light and you should be able to see in the shadow there's a rim of wine with droplets streaking down from it a few inches above the surface of the main body of the wine within the glass. And that is called tears of wine or wine legs sometimes. I have to say I prefer the tears better.
So this is inside the wine glass.
You get this rim of wine on the inside of the glass. And the way that comes to be is via a mechanism called the Marangoni convection, which is connected with the surface tension. Basically, surface tension means that fluids have a tendency to stick to other things. So you have this, your wine is going to climb slightly up the glass. And as it climbs up, the alcohol is going to evaporate faster than water because it's more volatile, and a mixture of wine which has less alcohol has higher surface tension, so more glass gets attracted towards it. So what you end up with is this very thin film of wine around the inside of your glass up to the level where you have this sudden increase in density which is connected to that mechanism. And then obviously it becomes too much wine, so it drops back into the glass, and it looks quite interesting.
Well, that sounds neat, but why would you want to look at this in space?
Basically, to eliminate all the influences of gravity, to be able to look into this mechanism more directly, because engineers are having plenty of problems with this mechanism. It's nothing you would normally observe in everyday life, but if you want to grow very advanced semiconductor systems or some biomedical devices, some optical materials, this can really produce significant problems within the production phase. So you want to understand this as much as you can in order to eliminate those issues and hopefully produce much better electronics and biomedical stuff for saving people's lives.
That sounds like a good plan.
Indeed. I believe it's time for the joke of the month.
Hey, Lauren.
Hi, Michelle.
Are you ready to hear an awesome joke of the month?
I'm ready.
Great. Drum roll, please. What do you call a loony spaceman?
I don't know. What do you call him?
An astronaut. Did not sound forced at all.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in to this month's Astropod. Don't forget about our special open afternoon edition that should be out quite soon. And tune in next month as well.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.